In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Love now and
did you fall in love last time?
I love
love was stronger than anything.
For the love,
can I love you more than anything?
There's to love.
Love.
From the New York Times, I'm Anna Martin. This is Modern Love. So a few years ago, I found my mom's childhood diary. On the front page in these really big bubble letters, she'd written, "Keep out." So I thought it would be juicy, but the wildest she got was talking about like her crush on this guy named Tony. And whenever she wrote his name, she drew this little heart around it. Most of the entries were just pure teen girl. How excited she was to wear the plaid bell-bottoms she'd saved up for. It was the 70s. Or when her friend said my mom's house smelled like weird Chinese food, so my mom said her friend's house smelled like wet dog. These little peeks into my mom's life, I felt like they were revelatory because I got to see how my mom told her own story. Entry by entry, I was witnessing my mom get to know herself in a way I really hadn't ever before. In today's essay, a mother shares something big with her son, a part of her narrative that she's kept hidden for years. This story is written and read by Ayad Akhtar.
"Can I get you two something cold to drink?" the poolside waiter asked my mother. It was a hot day. He was holding a check over his brow to block the sun and wearing only short shorts. He couldn't have presented a stronger contrast to the woman he was addressing. My mother was in a body-length, long-sleeved linen gown. "Virgin pina colada," she said. "Same," I said. My mother knew I drank alcohol, but she didn't like it when I drank in her presence. We were in Naples, Florida, on our family's annual spring break vacation, a tradition we had continued even as my brother and I entered midlife. At this point, the vacation routines were well honed. My father rose early and walked to the pier where he rented a pole and fished. My mother rose later and, after breakfast, planted herself by the pool to read. She was reading The Bluest Eye. But as we sat side by side in chaise lounges, she kept the book closed. I sensed her stewing and wondered what was bothering her. All at once, she turned to me and asked brightly, "Should we go for a walk along the water?" On the beach, my mother was the only person fully covered neck to foot. In all my years as her son, I had never seen her legs above the tops of her ankles and certainly never seen her in anything remotely like a swimsuit, though she'd worn one as a child, having learned and loved to swim. Whenever we walked along the water, she would roll up her pants or gather the front of her gown so she could feel the surf wash up over her feet. I'd often wondered if she missed being in the water, but I'd never thought to ask. I knew the choice was her own. My father was neither a practicing nor believing Muslim, and he wouldn't have cared if she wanted to show some skin. At 67, she was still beautiful, though less concerned with appearing so. My parents had met in Pakistan in the early 60s, both ridiculously attractive if the tales their friends told and the pictures taken of them at the time could be trusted. My mother's parents had fielded 24 proposals for her before she ended up surprising her family by falling in love with a fellow medical student in Lahore. My father's parents weren't any happier about the match. They'd already announced their decision to arrange their only son's marriage and selected a prospective bride. So they didn't even bother to show up to the wedding. Though theirs had been a love match, my parents' marriage was rocky from the start. My father had a wandering eye and didn't seem to feel that being married should stop him from acting on it. By the time I was 4, I already knew my father had other women, as my mother used to call them. This was their toxic central conflict, and it defined much of my childhood. It defined the narrative of their marriage, or so I thought. As she and I walked along the shore, her slippers in one hand, the front of her gown bunched up in the other, she started to tell me a story. In the mid-1980s, when I was not yet in high school, she had worked for a time at the Medical College of Wisconsin. An early specialist in nuclear imaging, she was in unusually high demand then, driving all over Milwaukee to read scans at various hospitals. Although her time covering shifts at the medical college had been short, barely 2 years, I had long known she was particularly fond of the place. I had always assumed her affection had something to do with the institution's prestige. But primarily, I would discover, it was about a man. A surgeon there. Like her, he was married, with 2 children. They met one night when he was on call and she was at the hospital late reading a scan for one of his patients. Tall, with dusty blonde hair and the build of an athlete, he had played football in college but didn't carry himself with the swagger and self-regard one tended to find, she said, in surgeons, especially those who had been athletes. He was humble, she said of the surgeon as she watched the water moisten her feet, an insinuation of a smile on her lips. That humility is what drew me to him. I was glad she wasn't looking at me as she spoke. I had never imagined my mother desiring my father, let alone another man. As startled as I was, I didn't want her to stop. We would meet in the canteen for dinner, she said. I didn't like the food there, so I brought desi food from home, dal, bhindi. He fell in love with Pakistani food. She looked at me. And he didn't fall in love with just Pakistani food. And he wasn't the only one. There was something about her face I didn't recognize. A quiet fierceness. She looked away. Up ahead, I thought I spied my father's silhouette on the horizon. It was about that time of morning when he started to make his way back to the hotel. My heart started to race. He wasn't happy with his wife, she said. I wasn't happy with my husband, but nothing happened. We each had 2 kids. We were from different cultures. What was the point of putting everyone through all that pain just so we could be happy? I know that's what a lot of people in this country think it means to be free, but that's not the kind of person I am. I knew this last idea about freedom was a rejoinder addressed to me about my father. I knew she felt this way about him, though I had come to wonder if it was a fair assessment. After all, he hadn't left his family either. The man ahead, I could see now, was indeed my father, trundling toward us with a red fish dangling from his hand. My mother still hadn't noticed him. "I think that's Dad up ahead," I said. She looked up. Speak of the devil. Got us some lunch, father said as he approached, holding up the fish. Snapper, going to take it to the kitchen to see what they can do. She replied, I just had breakfast. How about you? He said, turning to me. If her dismissal bothered him, I couldn't tell. Their long domestic strife waged in withering looks and muttered replies suddenly appeared less dramatic. Maybe it was just how they got through their decision to stay together. Sure, I said. Mom and I were walking, though. We'll see you back at the hotel? Once he was gone, my mother and I continued in silence. The atmosphere of complicity was gone. The confession was over. She dropped her gown as she headed for higher ground. I followed her to the top of a large dune. "Did you stay in touch with him?" I said as I joined her. She shook her head. "He moved away. We had a few letters, but that was it." She looked out at the ocean. After an awkward silence, she said, "I thought you should know." For a moment, I saw the younger, arresting woman I'd known as a child. I was finally seeing through the role she had played her whole life, that of my mother, a role I believed she had loved, and which had come to define her in so many ways. Not entirely. Our eyes met now, and her tentative, vulnerable expression surprised me. I fought the urge to look away and spare us a discomfort I assumed we were both feeling. Something new was happening between us. I didn't want to revert to being the son who only saw a mother he loved and needed, but who he assumed ultimately belonged to him. I held her gaze. "I'm glad you told me," I said. She smiled. We lingered on the dune a little longer, and then she gathered up her robe and we headed back down to the water.
After the break, another story about a child recognizing their parent for the very first time.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
I'm Peyton Roberts, and this is my tiny love story. I worry that our daughter Sadie, just 7 months old, would not recognize her father after his long deployment. So I wove him into her day, draping photographs of him inside her crib, video chatting with him as often as his work schedule and her nap routine allowed. Months later, at the airport the day of his return, I feared she wouldn't let this distant man hold her. His plane landed, our eyes met across the terminal. We raced to each other, my heart beating hard. Moments after we reunited, Sadie lunged from my hip into her father's arms. This deployment was special to our family because it was the first that my husband and I were parents. Deployments, the more you do them, the more difficult they get, the more draining they are. The next time my husband deployed, our daughter Sadie was 3.5 and our son Nate was 3 months old. At that time, I was pretty overwhelmed by the whole prospect of the 4.5 months that lay ahead of us. A few weeks before my husband left on that deployment, we started talking a little bit about Daddy's long work trip. My husband traveled a lot for work, so the fact that he was leaving wasn't out of the ordinary, but we wanted to try to convey to this three-year-old that the length of time would be different than what she was used to. So we got creative. I had our most recent family photograph printed onto a magnetic puzzle. And I broke the puzzle up into pieces, and each week, Sadie would get an envelope in the mail, and the envelope would have a couple pieces of the puzzle. Sadie might have been led to believe that the puzzle pieces were being mailed from Dad, but the logistics of that would have been a little maddening. So I took the pain point out of that and slipped the puzzle pieces into an envelope and wrote her name on it. And so week by week, she would, on the refrigerator, build together the picture of our family. And as the weeks went on, the picture of our family became more complete. It was a highlight of the week for all of us because it was a reminder that we were 1 week closer to Dad coming home. That reunion day is one that will always bring me to happy tears when I think about it. I remember the day we were loading up in the car to go pick him up from the military base. And I remember we got in the car early because I was so excited and we had to waste some time on the way. And so we went to the car wash. And as we're waiting to go through the car wash, this giant plane flies over and I realize, oh my gosh, that's Dad's plane. And so I will always remember being at the car wash at the end of this overwhelming deployment and watching this plane fly over and realizing like, oh my gosh, Sadie, Nate, we did it. Daddy is home.
On the next Modern Love, an incredible first date and the specific reason there wasn't a second. That's next week. Modern Love is produced by Julia Botero and Hans Buto, with help from Elissa Dudley and Vishaka Darba. It's edited by Sarah Saracen. This episode was mixed by Dan Powell, who also created the wonderful Modern Love theme music. Original music by Marion Lozano. Digital production by Mahima Chablani. The Modern Love column is edited by Daniel Jones, and Mia Lee is the editor of Modern Love Projects. I'm Anna Martin. Thanks for listening.